Good afternoon and welcome to the LaRouche Show. It's Saturday, January 15th, 2011, and I'm Harley Schlanger, and I will be your host. Today, we're going to take up the question of strategic policy at the highest level, which means we're going to talk very little about that British puppet, Barack Obama, who represents the gutter level of politics, and the sooner we get him out, the sooner we'll be able to actually get at these questions that are necessary for defining how a human civilization governs itself and develops the wealth for the future and develops in its young people the imagination that's needed to shape the future. Today we have to take up this question of how are we going to save this world of ours, which is now in a developing phase of hyperinflation, with price rises now very visible in food, in gas, in raw material prices, where we're getting very distinct warnings of food shortages which are emerging, and there are a number of nations which are being plunged into food riots. Now, this hyperinflation is caused by the actions of bankers associated with the Inter Alpha Group. And those of you who have been listening to the LaRouche Show regularly or who go to the LaRouche Pack website know very clearly what we mean when we talk about the Inter Alpha Group, an interlinked group of primarily City of London and Wall Street banking interests that are using the governments of the world today, especially in the transatlantic arena, to create trillions of dollars of new indebtedness, not for developing nations, not for developing the populations, but to bail out the bankrupt banks that have been saddled with unpayable debt due to the swindles that these bankers have been carrying out, especially over the last decade. And now to pay for their debt, they're demanding that those same governments that are bailing them out kill their citizens, starting with the sick, the elderly, and the poor, in an imitation of Adolf Hitler's T4 policy. This could be stopped, as Lyndon LaRouche has insisted over and over and over, by implementing a policy called Glass-Steagall, a program that was introduced in 1933 when Franklin Roosevelt took on the Depression, took on the banks on behalf of the people. Today, Glass-Steagall would not just end the bailouts, but it would put the banks through the bankruptcy reorganization that's necessary, throw out this worthless debt, and it would enable us to then invest new federal credit into major projects, beginning in the United States with NOAAPA, but projects which would crisscross the globe, developing Africa with the Transaqua, the Eurasian Land Bridge, the Darien Gap, and so on. Again, all of these projects have been delineated very beautifully on the LaRouche Pack website. So the question that keeps coming up is that how do we have this kind of existential crisis when the solutions are there and so simple? And that's what we're going to be discussing today. It also will be discussed next Saturday, and I want to make sure people put this on your calendar, next Saturday at 1 p.m. Eastern Time on LaRouche Pack, when Lyndon LaRouche will give his State of the Union address. And his State of the Union address will be about how to solve these problems, whereas several days after LaRouche speaks, President Barack Obama will give a State of his Narcissism address. So you're going to want to hear LaRouche, because LaRouche will be giving you the solutions. So today, as I mentioned earlier, we will be discussing this question of how did LaRouche come up with such a plan, which is the only alternative to not just a total breakdown collapse of the economy, but would address the unleashing of chaos, which will occur as the breakdown advances. Chaos of the sort we witnessed last Saturday with the mass murder in Tucson, Arizona. So the issue is not just economics, but exists on several other levels. We have to look at, for example, the gutlessness of the Congress, which in the face of an insane president continues to want to propitiate that president. And we have to look at the effect of the destruction of the future, which is what's happening with this hyperinflationary bailout policy. What effect does that have on a generation of youth when they lose their hopes for the future and instead are looking merely for immediate pleasure or fame, as in the case of the killer last Saturday? There are many potential walking time bombs set to go off. And what we could see is a chaos in the United States very much like what happened in 1789 with the unleashing of the terror in France. So the question then is, how do we bring back sanity in politics and in our civilization, which is always oriented to the future? And joining me today will be two people who are at the forefront of one of the most exciting and important projects on the face of the earth right now, which is the Basement Project, which LaRouche has launched, looking into the question, I would say, basically two issues, the question of cosmic radiation and its relationship to the question of the development of human creativity. So I'd like to welcome to the program Sky Shields and Ouyang Teng.
Hey, Harley.
Hey, Harley.
Now, we're going to look at this in the broadest sense, and I want you to feel free to keep coming back to this political question as we address the scientific questions, because I think what we want our listeners to get is a sense that you can't separate science from politics or science from history or science from policy, because doing that is what's gotten us into this crisis. So the two related issues that I'd like to start with, one which I've gotten some questions on already from people, what is cosmic radiation and why must this be at the center of policymaking? And then secondly, the relationship of the senses to the human mind and to the process of discovery of universal principles of nature. So to start with, I'll throw out to either of you who want to start, you know, when we look at this question of cosmic radiation, we've heard over the centuries the discussion of questions of heat and light and sound waves, and then the discovery of electromagnetic waves, the infrared rays, the whole electromagnetic spectrum. And the question sort of comes up is, do these represent a kind of cosmic soup? Is this what we're talking about with cosmic radiation?
I mean, yeah, it's funny you should mention that. When that came up today in discussions with Mr. LaRouche, with Lynn on this topic, what he said, look, if you want to get, you know, it might be a funny starting place, but it actually is the most illustrative starting place. You want to get an idea of what he means, what we mean by cosmic radiation, what we're talking about in this most recent report, take a look at what just happened in Arizona. He said that's a perfect example of what this is as a phenomenon. You've got all these people who are sitting back debating and putting forward ridiculous, absolutely idiotic theories about, you know, what drove the shooter, what motivated the shooter, this kid who was nuts. You know, was it, you know, trying to connect it to the image of gun sights on a campaign page from Sarah Palin or something like this. And the point LaRouche made is, look, this is the culture. You know, he's an easy case to figure out. He's simply nuts. There's not much more digging into him that's going to give you any more insight into what's taking place, unless you recognize that what you saw there, what you saw in Arizona, is just symptomatic of the state that we're in right now, the cultural state that we're in. And it's got nothing to do with, you know, how heated the political discussion is. It's got to do with the fact that over the course of the last several decades, we've created a culture that's got no respect at all for human life. We've created a culture that's got no concept. Nothing in today's culture is designed to give anybody a concept of a future. You've got a real kind of dehumanized liberalism that governs everything, and it's epitomized by the economic policies of free trade and globalization. The idea that human life is of no value, human creativity is of no fundamental value, that instead you're going to measure this stuff in monetarist terms, that you can measure the value of human life in terms of dollars and cents, like what you saw with this, with the health care bill that Obama's rammed through, and then the extra executive order elements to it that he's ramming through.
Well, Sky, now let me ask you, because I think this is getting in an important direction, something you just mentioned, the question of human life and human creativity, because you have among certain people who claim to be pro-life and that that's their major focus, there's some of the same people who are arguing that we should cut the budget to the bone because we don't have the money to pay for things. But
Right. You're
connecting this question of human life in a broader way to creating the conditions where we can develop a truly creative society. How does that work?
No, yeah, we say, we're making the point, what we're arguing is pro-life. What the other side argues on this is don't kill them until they're born. We've said that before in the past. That, you know, they've got sort of a, the so-called left-wing and right-wing ideologies you've got inside the U.S. right now are just ridiculously, there's no principle governing them, either side of it. They've got this random assortment of single issues, on some of which each side is right on, some of which each side is wrong on, but they're completely wrong in that there's no principle that's governing this. The scientific principle, again, is what you saw in this case, what you saw in Arizona, is you're seeing that there's no such thing as individual, as human beings operating as individuals, as particles in society, except to the extent that they're willing to act on society to change it. If you're not acting on all society to change it, then you're governed by the field in which you exist. And this is the cosmic radiation question, that there's principles, there's a social principle mediated in various ways, and in ways, some of these ways are uninvestigated, and we're tapping into a number of these in this report we're putting out. But there are social principles that are mediated that govern the activities of the singularities, of the singular individuals in that society. They're expressions of the direction society's moved in as a whole.
Now, I would assume that from listening to some of what Mr. LaRouche said today, this gets at the question of something like Glass-Steagall, and I'd like Ouyang to comment on this, because he has said that the problem you have is that people see Glass-Steagall as a technical banking question, as opposed to a question of a scientific principle of how you organize a society. And Ouyang, is that getting at the direction of what Skye is talking about?
Yeah, LaRouche had also phrased it, from the standpoint that it's not even that people are missing specific principles. You know, that would be problematic enough, but that the development or lack of development culturally, and he specifically identified the Congress for Cultural Freedom, which is, you know, the kind of flagship agency for brainwashing, you know, generations of post-war Americans and Europeans and others, that through that kind of cultural process, people have lost the capability to even recognize principled changes of state, or to be able to look at a state of organization as something that's principled, whether you're talking about a state of organization of some aspect of physical space-time, whether or not that's the culture. It's that you sort of have no capability conceptually in the population to recognize these downshifts for what they are, and alternatively to measure it against what the upshifts necessarily have to be. And so that in terms of economics, you locate those kinds of developments that you call progress from the standpoint of purely physical terms of reference. And those physical terms of reference have a sort of an analog in and are situated within a whole process of development on the planet as a whole. Human economy represents the sort of pinnacle of principles of development as they've been manifested on the planet so far. So when you get to an issue like Glass-Steagall, it's not simply a change in monetary regulation, because to the extent that people are stuck in the terms of monetarist discussion, you've already lost it. You're incapable at that point of describing what a future state has to be. The best you're able to do at that point is to recognize that there's a problem. And so, I think we're at the point where it doesn't really. It's not enough to just recognize the problem.
So part of what you're saying, then, I get from both of you, is that we're actually looking at a question of how you measure things. On the one side, you have statistical analysis, mathematical analysis of money, for example, to just stick with the economy for a moment. On the other side, you're looking at actual qualitative changes in physical capability, transformations. Is that getting at what you're talking about, how these kinds of questions intersect in economy?
Right. Yeah, if you can break people away from their commitment to arbitrary belief systems and arbitrary belief and arbitrary value systems, then you've at least opened up the possibility to discuss what those, you know, what direction society has to go. And then from that standpoint, then from the standpoint of policy, or it's actually a scientific discussion, and it's outside of the realm of ideology or you know, just some belief system, then you can really say there are non-negotiable, you know, values by which the human species necessarily exists. And, you know, what we see right now is that has to be based on as much as possible the widest application of scientific principle in your economy as a whole, to continually move from any given state of consumption and production to the next state, and that next state is going to define a higher capability to then move to the state after that.
Okay. Well,
right. There's no way to get there. Go on.
Go ahead.
Exactly. I mean, that's the point to get. And this is to be able to move in that way. I mean, it should be clear if that's from an understanding of the direction the human species needs to move in, and the goals that we need to reach. I mean, take the idea of the creation of NAWAPA as an example. What's physically needed for the U.S. You realize that the kind of free trade, free market policies that Glass-Steagall would eliminate, that those kinds of policies, the free market, you know, as a concept, is completely alien to the human species' natural method of organizing itself, the lawful method for the human species to organize itself. The way to get sort of an example, what we looked at in this recent report as kind of a case study, so that people can see some examples from the development of the biosphere to use as a foil to see what the specific advancements are that the human species makes on top of the biosphere's development. We looked at the cases of migratory birds and their ability to sense the structure in various ways, the structure of the Earth's magnetic field. And you use them doing a detailed study there of just how many elements are involved, that it becomes so complex, their ability to sense the field, that it's not something like a simple sense. It's not as though they're simply seeing it or simply feeling it. But they've got a very complex set of, they're complexly tied into the way the different variations in intensity, variations in polarity of the Earth's magnetic field, their ability to recognize that their location and the time of the year, etc., from magnetic cues mediated in different ways by different types of light. As you start to investigate this, and then you extend it, and you realize that there's all sorts of other animal examples mm-hmm. that are very similar but different. In the case of migrating sea turtles, the electric senses that you get in sharks, platypuses, other kinds of creatures, you start to realize that the way that you can't really treat these things, even an organism, as some kind of a discrete object that's just sort of sensing other things around it some kind of kinetic fashion. You have to start to view the process as a single whole. But there's one process there, especially when you start to look at its evolution, the biosphere's development, and that within that continuous process, you get singularities that you start to recognize as discrete objects. So if you take what they're sensing and you say, well, instead of them being some kind of recording device that's being pummeled by something, you take, well, what is that continuous medium that they're a singularity in? Then you're looking at its electromagnetic properties, you're looking at its other physical properties, then you've got an idea of what we mean when we say cosmic radiation. Mm. Especially as you start to extend that off the Earth and you realize that the Earth itself is just a singularity in a much larger continuous system there. That you've got a process that is developing as a whole, that is not built up from the bottom up, a bunch of tiny survival of the fittest operations that are building up to form an organized whole. You've got one directed intentionality there that in order to manifest itself has to singularize itself.
So it's not just sky that birds start to get cold and they, by habit, tend to head toward the south.
Yes, right, exactly.
You're listening to The LaRouche Show. We're taking up one of the most fundamental issues that I think it's fair to say will determine whether the human race is going to make it or not, which really, at its heart, is how do we think about the human mind? Because ultimately, you just threw something out there, Sky, about this question of looking from the top down. Well, what is the top? Why don't you guys give us a sense of that? And before I go any further, let me say, if people do have questions, We'll try to get in your questions. You can send email questions in to radio@larouchepub.com, LaroucheP.com, radio@larouchepub.com. If we don't get to your questions on the air, I'm sure Sky and Ouyang and other people in the basement would be happy to take them up. And we want you to participate in this because this is not just a question of listening to these guys and saying, well, that's interesting, but how are we going to get Glass-Steagall? It's the change in your thinking that makes you an active participant in this process that actually begins to put you into the real world, the world defined by this from the top-down cosmic radiation. So, Sky or Ouyang, what is the top? When you say look at things from the top, what is it?
I would start there. I mean, I think there's a number of different ways you could begin there, but I think what it starts with is what your intention is. You know, what do you want to do? To a large degree, the kinds of questions that people are capable of asking depend on what it is that they want to accomplish. So take Nuwapa, again, as an example. There are certain areas of investigation which pertain directly to this, what Sky was bringing up about the kind of integrated, you know, what we call the environment is actually this continuously developing process of the biosphere around us that intersects larger solar and galactic processes. Well, you know, one of the ways in which we're concretely going to be able to investigate that is through the development and the expansion of human civilization into places like the polar regions which are touched by Nuwapa and similar kinds of projects. Alternatively, those sorts of projects, those kinds of large-scale bioengineering projects, force you to consider what it is, what the environment actually is in which you're acting, and what you're intending to create through the action. And so a lot of questions about, which right now tend to be very abstract, and very descriptive from the standpoint of saying, well, let's sit back, create a model, and then talk about the model. Sciences such as the study of climate will take on a whole new aspect when you begin to say, in what ways do we need to actually affect and change that process? And so I think, you know, if you want to put yourself in a position to ask certain relevant questions, you have to start with the idea that there's, you know, what we intend to accomplish is to move the human species forward in a way that right now is impossible under the current conditions.
Well, you know, it's interesting to start with that, because if you look back several months at what was the initiation of the whole series of discussions on cosmic radiation, it came out of a discussion of a Mars mission at a point at which the president was tearing down the space program. So you had, on the one hand, the retrogressive action of an insane president who said, we're not going to spend money on this because it doesn't do any good for us, as opposed to LaRouche and echoing people like John Kennedy and others, where it used to be the same thing to do, to say we're going to Mars. So that's where I think we got started on this question of cosmic radiation, wasn't it, Sky?
I mean, I'd say, yeah. I mean, I get the idea. For us, it sort of gives you, that's our kind of our point that we're viewing, our point in the future we're aiming towards. But we can take our cue on how to get there from, and what we stress, what's been a major part of the cosmic radiation project has been looking at taking a cue from the evolution of the biosphere. I mean, if you take a look at, you know, there is a, the universe prior to mankind appearing as a singular phenomenon, there is a creative principle that you have embodied in the universe, responsible for whatever the constant creation of the universe that was already moving in a very clear direction, according to certain very clear principles that it never violated. One principle is an increase, steady increase in energy flux density. That's never been violated in the development of the solar system, in the development of the universe or the solar system.
Well, Sky, let me ask you, because the dominant scientific view goes against that now because it's characterized by the second law of thermodynamics.
right, with no evidence to justify it. I mean, everything, if you take a look at the history of the development of the biosphere, every step has been a step towards increased complexity, towards increased organization, further and further away from equilibrium, further and further away from so-called stable states. It development is anti-entropic, fundamentally, the development of the universe is. And LaRouche has stressed that this is an economic principle. It's a principle of the universe, but it's a principle of economics.
A There's principle no, even before man, you're saying.
Prior to us getting here, that's what the universe wants. You never find a case where the biosphere or anything else moves for sustainable development.
Could you say the creation of human life was the intention of the universe?
I would say we epitomize that. We're the entire that whole process of the development of the universe, the development of the solar system, the development of the biosphere. There's a long process of anti-entropic development. Nowhere in there do you see the reign of the second law as a governing principle, except in isolated cases within that, isolated closed systems within that. The system as a whole moves in the opposite direction.
Let me just take 1 minute then so that we can dispense with this argument for all those people out there who are studying high school physics. And how do they get away with arguing that the second law of thermodynamics is the characteristic of the universe?
On this, I actually recommend people read, you know, not too much because they're boring, but read things directly from Clausius, directly from Boltzmann, because you'll never find a set of more hand-wavy arguments anywhere. Just know they make simple statements that are verifiable about heat engines, which don't go beyond anything Carnot himself said, that Sadi Carnot himself said, and then they make the wild leap to statements about universal entropy with no connection there. And if you look, they've all got insane political, philosophical agendas. I mean, Boltzmann expresses his, and I think it's pinnacle in his own suicide, it's sort of his vision of the universe, his theological conception of how the universe works is expressed in how he ends his own life. But none of it is based on scientific fact. Fact is everything we know about the history, everything we can find in the fossil record, everything we can find about the history of the development of our solar system says you've had a continuous process over time periods that are too huge to even difficult to conceive of steady anti-entropic development. And with mankind, with human beings, you see that encapsulated in that whole process of development is encapsulated in singular human individuals. The ability to make those kinds of successive changes that in animals would correspond to evolutionary leaps, you find several of those are possible within the lifetime of a single human genius.
Well,
I'm
partly just drawing this out because I think it gets back to what we started with, which is that if you have a society which accepts such things as the law of entropy, the second law of thermodynamics, it is a no-future society.
Right.
And it makes the point that this question that we're talking about is not esoteric, but actually gets down to the real guts of how you make policy.
Right.
Part of that is the idea that the universe is fundamentally explained by the ways in which you can break things down in non-living physics, in the abiotic. You know, that is a perfect example of saying we're going to study the properties of a heat engine and then extrapolate from that somehow represents some kind of ontological basis by which you'd build up the rest of the universe. And, you know, I think it's a kind of a tough proposition to swallow that if God was going to create the universe, you know, he'd start with, a heat engine. To say, you know, some of what we're finding when you begin to look at the, for example, a very good area to sort of break open the whole, even the meaning of basic concepts in physics, is the interaction of living organisms with different so-called regions of the electromagnetic spectrum. That what we find is that, as in the case of birds, in the case of insects, in the case of basically everywhere you look in the biosphere, there's very specific kinds of regulation, very specific kinds of organization in the way that matter, so-called matter and energy, interact. Now, if we take our cue from those kinds of interactions, recognizing that the principle of anti-entropic development is driving that kind of process, then you can project downward and begin to make sense of the so-called fundamental concepts of physics, but rework from the higher standpoint of biology and beyond that of human cognition. So it's also there's an inversion involved in actually taking on this concept of cosmic radiation, which is to say that you're actually starting with a principle of development, starting with an ontology. You have to recognize what the ontology is, and then work your way downward to other physical processes, instead of starting with somebody's steam engine.
Well, now this also, you raise this question of cognition. It gets at the other point that I'd like you to discuss on this program. Let me just remind the listeners, this is the LaRouche Show. It's Saturday, January 15th, 2011. Next Saturday will be Lyndon LaRouche's webcast, 1 p.m. Eastern Time on LaRouche Pack and LaRouche Pub. Now, Ouyang, you just raised this question, and we've been talking about, in a sense, an evolution of the work in the basement. When Lynn introduced the cosmic radiation project, one of the things that he started with was the importance of demolishing the idea that you can know anything through sense perception. But in his more recent papers, he's raising a question about the higher faculties of the senses. And from looking through your paper, Sky, the very fascinating paper by Aaron Halavy on the cosmic chorus, Peter Martinson's work, what you did, Ouyang, Megan Roulard, we're actually looking at this question of the development of the powers of the human mind, what Lynn called in a recent article the sixth sense. So, Sky, I'd like you to just talk about that in the context and in relationship to this question of cosmic radiation. How is it that we're, or what is it about the human mind that enables us to do this?
I mean, this is the important one. I mean, this is, if you look, there's a whole arc of discussion that goes through Plato's work, in particular his Meno dialogue, but also his Phaedo. It goes through the work of Gottfried Leibniz in his Discourse of Metaphysics by way of Johannes Kepler in the Book 4 of his Harmonies of the World. All these discussions, you get a discussion of sense perception, but then of the relationship of the human mind to sense perception, which all of them make the point that you cannot introduce anything into the human mind by way of the senses. That any attempt to try and describe that way as a sort of blank slate idea that the mind somehow comes into the world empty and has things written upon it. That all of that always runs into problems. It's fundamentally paradoxical, the only conclusion you can come to is that the process of human knowledge is somehow using external cues to draw new ideas from out from inside of the mind. The way Plato referred to this was his doctrine of remembrance. Every act of learning is as though you were remembering something that was already inscribed in your soul that you had forgotten at some point. The way Leibniz words it is that you know everything already but confusedly, and learning is a process of unraveling that confused knowledge. And Kepler's description, which is very useful for the discussion we're having now, from the standpoint of sense perception, is that you're seeing a harmonic resonance, that something in the individual human soul resonates with the entire universe in such a way that any bit of knowledge that's knowable is capable of being drawn out from inside the soul. The expression, you find that in a simplified but very nice and condensed form in the Judeo-Christian notion that man's made in the image and likeness of the Creator. That's not simply a platitude, but you really do see a scientific principle in that. What you're saying is that the individual human being somehow, in a singular way, mirrors the entire process of creative development of the universe as a whole. And every one of these major thinkers that you've had, every scientific thinker who's had a role in furthering the development of human society has recognized that and has worked to figure out how to communicate that.
Well, it's interesting, Sky, you bring that up. That means this concept of know thyself is not just what people try to reduce it to in pop psychology, know your limitations, but it's actually by knowing the way the mind works, you can learn about the universe.
Yeah, and it's the only way, exactly. There is no objective universe that you're studying. The attempts to do that will run you into paradoxes that are along the lines of what Gödel predicted in his critique of Russell's project with the Principia Mathematica. That there is no complete deductive system. That every deductive system at a certain point, in order to account for itself, has to be able to refer to a creative principle that generates it. That you do have to, and the same is true for the universe as a whole. There's no set of fixed principles, mechanical or otherwise. There's no set of fundamental particles or fundamental forces that will account for the development of the entire universe. In that sense, it's not a closed system. It's not a logically closed system. And that's it. It's an open system. And it requires you to account for any phase space. It requires you to look at a phase space that's higher. To account for the lawfulness in the abiotic, you have to look to a higher phase space, the biotic. To account for the lawfulness that you find in the biotic, you've got to look for a higher phase space, the cognitive. And it will always be the highest that's your ultimate causality there. In the case of the universe, you've got a subsuming cognitive principle that has to be the source of causality for everything below it. And attempts to try to explain things within the lower phase spaces will run into insoluble paradoxes, as they should, such as the paradox of wave-particle duality that you run into, attempting to exhaust abiotic physics without looking to any other phase spaces above them. You know, that ends in the insanity of the Copenhagen interpretation of quantum mechanics.
Well, this is the real battle in science right now, because what you've just described with Bertrand Russell as the modern enforcer of the Sarpy ideas is precisely the fight that we're engaged in, whether it's on economic policy, whether it's on mental health policy, for example, cultural policy. So the implications of this, Ouyang, actually stretch to every activity of human endeavor.
It's also important to recognize that there are all kinds of currently unconscious influences on human perception, on the way in which we interact with the world around us. And, you know, part of the idea of studying what we might call the extended sensorium, including studies of animal perception, is to gain a greater insight into the degrees of freedom that the human mind necessarily requires of its physiology and of its sense perceptual apparatus to be able to be able to act in the world. And that's some of what is represented in this report that we just put out. That if it's not exhaustive by any means, but if you take as a whole, it gives a picture that is, again, coming back to one of the first questions we were discussing here today, is to be able to assimilate and really internalize the idea that you are not simply a product of what your perceptions in the moment tell you, what your conscious perceptions in the moment tell you, but that there are a lot of, you know, a kind of an infinitely subtle array of interactions and perceptions to which we're susceptible, and to the degree that we can become conscious of these, it has far-reaching implications, including, I would say, for the development of language, for the way in which we even discuss questions of causality and you know, the terms in which we refer to physical processes. So it can take us into a whole new direction as far as the way in which science is carried out, which, by the way, is a direction which was consciously stopped in the post-war period, and at some level, not quite at the level that LaRouche has outlined. These questions were being You know, these were the questions that people were struggling with, people like Einstein, Vernadsky, Wolfgang Kurler, Planck, and others, is to reconcile the sort of seeming paradoxes between the existing state of the development of language, be it mathematical or any other kind of language, and the kinds of real physical paradoxes that were coming up in science. And the direction that they were pushing was to break the existing, you know, mold in science, and unfortunately, that was crushed, basically after World War II.
Well, this comes back to another very often discussed topic by Lyndon LaRouche, which is the relationship of classical culture to the sciences. And I know that this is something that Aaron looked at in his paper, and Sky, you've done a lot of work on this also. You mentioned Einstein, and Shauna did the video on Einstein and his violin. Why is it, then, that classical culture and actual creative discovery in science are so interrelated?
I mean, on one level, if you take that idea what we discussed earlier, that you have to view the physical universe top-down, the cognition has to be primary, and then everything beneath it is something that's derived. It's not a bottom-up construction. The higher phase spaces aren't epiphenomena. Life is not just an organization of the abiotic, and cognition is not just a bizarre kind of life. That creative principle that governs cognition is what's primary. That's the first thing you have. And, you know, in certain religions, you get them as creation stories. You get the idea of cognition itself acting on itself to produce a physical universe in some form or another. But that's describing a real principle there. If that's clear, then you realize that there are going to be certain principles of mind that are irreducibly principles of mind. And those you can only work with, you're not going to be able to describe those with sets of equations, et cetera. Those are mathematical language. Those are created to describe the lower phase spaces of physics, and they even fall apart as you try to approach biology more accurately.
This comes back to the question of measurement then again, because ultimately you can measure successful hypotheses based on the improvements of living conditions as measured with potential relative population density and energy flux density. Is that?
I think so, yeah. In this case, so the metric, I would say, is classical composition. It really is. Like, the lawfulness of mind, the place where you're studying mental laws as cognitive laws, cognition as cognition, is in music, is in the arts. Those aren't the current, what's popular currently is to say, well, art is just sort of what you feel. It's arbitrary. But it's not. There are, like you're saying, the value of an art, you can tell by what it does to a culture. You can tell by what effect it has on an individual's ability to express creativity effectively in the universe. But you know that because the universe is obeying those exact same laws. The human mind is not some limitation that we're stuck with. You often get presented this idea that, were we just computers, we would function so much better. If that were true, computers would be building humans rather than vice versa.
Well, and this also gets at the question that Lynn posed in the interrelationship of fugal counterpoint and tensor analysis, that the ability to develop the mind to be able to take in an increasingly complex density of singularities as a one really is
right.
This same question, no?
Right. No, I think definitely that. The ability to work with ones, to work with gestalts. And this is what, you know, something that's often overlooked with all these, the real, you know, some of the gestalt thinkers and people related to them at the beginning of this last century, is that there really is creative composition is the art of recognizing ones, wholes, ideas, whole concepts, governing concepts. Because if you can recognize, if you exercise your ability in the arts, and classical art only classical composition, you exercise your ability to think in this way, and then you turn and look at the universe, and you find, as you should, that the universe organizes things this way. It begins with a principle of organization, and then the parts follow suit.
Well, and then, Ouyang, let me come back to you on this question of the sensorium. Where do the senses fit in? And I mean senses now not as the limited five senses, but the subdivisions of the senses, the interaction of the senses, the higher senses. Can we increase our ability to have sense perceptions cohere with advances of creativity?
Yeah, I mean, I would say that, you know, what, this actually was taken up. If people listening haven't yet, they should look at a report that was put up by Sky and a few others entitled, In What Sense Do You Mean Immortality? And in that, I think it's a very effective presentation of just how provisional our given instrumentation, our given sense perceptual array actually is, and that there's no reason why that is fixed. And in fact, I would say that we can be fairly certain that it goes the other way, that we're, the human species, as it develops, will necessarily develop new instrumentation, new sense modalities, because their character, as their sort of finite character, is that they are conditional, they are provisional. And, you know, it's sort of, I mean, to come to the higher point, referring back to Leibniz, you know, he says that every monad, every, you know, true substance in the universe sort of reflects the entire universe, but as if from, you know, different angles. It's as if you're looking at a city from a bunch of different angles. You know, there's never going to be a complete picture in the sense of a literal picture, because you don't have, as Sky mentioned, you're not looking at some objective universe out there in some fixed state. So I think, you know, we're looking at, when we discuss sense perception, particularly in humans, it's something which is, I think, capable and susceptible to a continual development, one which I think we have a very dim conception of right now. I would also say, just, you know, Sky brought up this, you know, the question of why computers don't build humans, and we can see in cases that come close to that, where people really are programmed by the computer games, and, you know, their kind of activity online and so forth, it has disastrous results. And this is something that we referred to in our pamphlet back in 2007, The Devil in Your Laptop, that, you know, the kinds of phenomena that you saw with this Tucson shooting is indicative of a culture which has lost a sense of connection to an efficient connection to reality. And so you really, you know, the things that we're discussing now, they go to the core of what is the, you know, generative principle of all the problems in society right now, when you take that away from people and you try to impose, again, a false conception of the human mind, in which people then have a naive interpretation of even their own experience and their own sense perception. And then that leads to totally aberrant and crazy behavior, which is just an expression in these singular instances, like we saw last week with the shooting, an expression of a cultural sickness.
I would say the same thing is true of people who have a belief in money, that money is somehow value, that it reflects a lower degree of sense certainty. But Sky, I want to come back to you on this question of the development of the senses, or the interrelationship of the senses, because you wrote a paper that, and by the way, are these papers going to be published, the papers that have been produced recently?
They are. They're available now on the site as a single package.
Where would people find them?
Do you know the direct path?
I think there, if you go to the LaRouche PAC site, there's probably a link on the front page or in the updates section.
Is there a basement page? Isn't that where these are usually posted?
Well, these are all posted to one page, which has all the reports linked off of it.
Okay, so if people want to follow this up, there are very fascinating reports on insects, on you can say more. As the, I think Aaron's paper on the ear and hearing raises some of these same questions about why you have to hear things from above as opposed to look at an apparatus as the sum of its parts. But Sky, on this hearing question, you raise a very interesting thing about the aurora borealis and the relationship of sight and sound. I wonder if you can just summarize what you have in your paper on that.
Just to draw out, the idea was to take a look at a couple of these things where you attempt to, I mean, you get the reports. I think some people are familiar that you get reports of many people who go out and view the aurora borealis, hear a sound that's connected with it, likewise, many people hear similar sounds connected with passing meteorites. That may not seem so strange until you recognize that the location of the aurora borealis is such that it can't produce sound waves, as you know, sound waves. It's not where it is in the ionosphere. The gas of the atmosphere is too rarefied to be able to produce vibrations that would make it to the ground as sound. And furthermore, in the case of the meteorites, the sound is reaching you as the meteorite passes, which people who've observed lightning strikes realize should be impossible. There should be some, at least, given the distance of meteorites at the time you see them burning up, which is around 100 or so miles above the ground, it should take a good 5 minutes for that sound to reach you. So the implication is that what you're hearing is something else besides typical sound waves, and certainly it is the case as you try to record these on normal recording devices, you don't record them. The human organism, however, is able to recognize these sounds as sounds, and you start to realize that the simple definition of sound as vibration of airwaves, rather than the actual definition of it as what you hear, suddenly you realize that in that definition, you're able to cut off whole sections of the world that have an ontological significance by your definition. And I made the joke that it's sort of like the effect of trying to say define, to say that all you'll define as sound, you only define sound as these air vibrations, is like, you know, asking somebody what sort of rock their baby is. That by the way you phrase the question, by the fact that you say that this should be recordable on this device, you automatically redefine the thing you're trying to record as what you record, as the thing you managed to record. You substitute your theory for reality. And so in this paper, I made a point to look at some of these so you could really extend, well, what are you really hearing when you hear sound, just to give people a visceral sense, but in order to set up the discussion in the case of musical composition. Is it true that everything that you hear in a real live classical musical performance is recorded in the course of any recording, but certainly in the course of a digitized recording, which is reducing the recording to nothing but the information that you think would be, that you define as available to you for hearing? You know, the question is, well, what are you cutting out when you define that baby as a rock?
Well, and this comes back to some other papers Megan Roulard wrote about the phenomenal case of Helen Keller, and I always come back to the case of Beethoven, who in all of his late compositions, he could hear nothing. He tried to do experiments by seeing if he could pick up the vibrations of the piano as a sense perception of touch. But you have someone who had lost his hearing, and you could say, well, he knew what he heard when he was younger, but who could write complex compositions, beautiful compositions, the late string quartets, the Ninth Symphony, without being able to hear. And so clearly, this question of being able to hear is something that's not the percussive effects of sound waves, but something that exists in the mind. Anyway, we have about
Beethoven.
Go ahead.
Yeah, in Beethoven's case, you get the amazing thing that he's introducing things that certainly didn't exist when he had his hearing. All of his later work, he's got fundamental innovations that are completely unlike anything that existed before. So it's not some simple repetition, you know, recreation of what it was he once knew.
Yeah. Yeah, especially late quartets, you have that phenomena.
Right.
All right, we have just over 6 minutes, and I'd like to bring this down to this question then that with this fight over policy, Glass-Steagall, NWAPA, Ouyang, how does NWAPA represent both a solution for social and economic problems, as well as entering into this whole new realm of hypothesis of the nature of man?
Well, it's first of all one conception. It exists as you know, an elegant solution both to existing problems, but also to the problems that we want to create in the future. It is a platform. And that's a concept that LaRouche is in the process of developing through his writings, but it really does give a very good concrete example, I think, of what a true economic platform is, that you're talking about a reorganization at a number of different levels. you're talking about, number one, a conception which goes to the heart right now of the backwardness, the cultural backwardness that says that, you know, we have to limit human activity, that, this is the kind of the rallying cry of the environmental movement, which is really a false, completely synthetic movement funded by people who want to depopulate the planet. But it goes to the heart of that by saying that the interest, both of the United States, but in cooperation with other countries, because, again, NOAAPA is going to involve the U.S., Canada, and Mexico minimally, and, of course, is going to lead to a bunch of spin-off projects like the Bering Strait and so forth, the Darien Gap project, but that it means that our interest as a nation and as a nation cooperating with other sovereign nations is to act on a minimally a continental scale, to reorganize both the existing kind of hydrological and other biospheric processes within that continent, but in the process also reorganize the very basis of the economy in terms of mobilizing men and materiel, and using this as a vector for a nuclear renaissance in the United States, that NOAAPA is going to be the vehicle by which we have in one fell swoop a get to the level of a nuclear infrastructure that we should have had 30 years ago. Now, all of these, all of the manifestations of the project can, each of them is in itself, a worthy cause. But I think the important, in terms of employment, reindustrialization and so forth, but the important thing is that, again, it's going to pull us forward into a future which we can conceptualize now, but it's a future which actually defines a different state for the country and for the world.
It's a change in thinking.
Our role in the universe is to act on the widest possible level.
Yeah, it's a fundamental change in thinking.
We
make jokes down here in Texas about how Texans used to think big, and now they think big is the size of their hat or their belt. And, of course, Texans need very big belts. But this idea of thinking, again, outside of the bounds of our atmosphere. And Sky, I wonder if you'd just like to give some inspirational words to move people into taking up this project as their life's work to finish the program.
I mean, if you take a look at the scale on which, as we discussed earlier, the development of the biosphere, we made this point about the introduction of the Earth's atmosphere by life. What's not often discussed is if you view the Earth from space, the interaction between the electromagnetic field, interplanetary electromagnetic field produced by the Sun and the Earth, turns us into an amazing beacon of cosmic radiation. We're not just absorbing it, we're emitting it. There's a cone of wave of radiation that's emitted from the Earth with the aurora's cross-section. That's comparable in our solar system only to the Sun and Jupiter. It's amazing. This is done by living processes. If you think about the relationship of cognitive processes on Earth to living processes, our steady takeover of what was once a domain of life and our amplification and our increasing the effectiveness of life, we're going to move life with NOAAPA. We're going to move life to places it couldn't reach in the deserts. We're going to take it further. What it means is that our destiny in doing that, as sort of stewards, as controllers of the biosphere, is to take control of that amazing force that is the Earth's atmosphere, that amazing beacon of generating the cosmic radiation that's moving outward from us. You know, that's an amazing destiny for us to have as a species. You want to talk about thinking big, the idea that as individual human beings, we're going to talk about organizing the entire radiative environment of not just our solar system, but of the galaxy as a whole, because that's what life participates in. You know, I think that's just an amazing idea, and people should think of that, and it lets you get to something that's much larger than this sort of chaotic atomization that you get, that you saw manifested in Arizona just this past week.
Well, and it also
means littleness.
As we're almost out of time, it also means that we have to get that little bum Obama out of the White House, because we're not going to be able to do any of this with the British puppet Barack Obama running policy. Sky and Ouyang, this has been a really interesting discussion. People should go to the LaRouchePack.com website because in addition to the papers, we're going to be doing some interviews. I know there'll be some video work coming up. So thanks again, and remember, next Saturday, 1 p.m. Eastern Time, Lyndon LaRouche's State of the Union Address. Thanks for joining us. We'll see you next week.